Picture three men. They are beyond sight or healthy diet. Isolated by a virus, they decide to turn to old TV for solace. Will they find comfort? Or will they find the Twilight Zone?
Welcome to our penultimate episode of the Twilight Zone Zone. This week, it's just Daniel and I as we crack out two, well, one is classic, one I'd seen once before, episodes. We're doing Five Characters in Search of an Exit and such a nothing name, Nothing in the Dark. One is, of course, a Rod Serling, and the other one is not. Which maybe explains why I liked one more than the other. So, like normal, we'll start with Five Characters in Search of an Ending, and I'll read the narration. Clown, hobo. Gotta get my Serling on. A clown? A hobo. I love the way he uses his teeth. A bagpiper and an army major. A collection of question marks. Five improbable entities stuck together into a pit of darkness. No logic, no reason, no explanation. Just a prolonged nightmare in which fear, loneliness, and the unexplicable walk hand in hand in the shadows. In a moment, they'll start collecting clues as to the whys, the whats, and the wheres. We will not end the nightmare. We'll only explain it, because this is the Twilight Zone, which is just something.
You know, if you really want to do Serling, you need a cigarette in your mouth.
I do.
Or like a cocktail just all out of frame.
I need to age myself 5 years, but like 20 in dog years. Like, because the man had a grizzle.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there you go. Speaking of a cocktail out of frame.
That's right. What do we got?
Well, this first one is actually fairly simple, and it's also pretty famous, just because it really is five random characters trying to get out of a prison. The army major, who knows he's an army major but doesn't remember anything else about who he is or how he got there, wakes up and finds himself in this prison that's like this giant metal cylinder that's got an open roof, but there's no other way out of, seemingly, to get out. So he's trying to encourage everyone else how to try and help him escape, and the clown, who I thought was Cesar Romero, but it's not Cesar Romero. I would have bet money it was, and I would have lost that bet. So, yeah, Nick, I guess I'll give you $20 after this is over. They're trying to say it's useless, and the major's the only one who's trying to get out of this prison. And he's trying to convince the others to do so. And, well, the way it escalates is they try, and from there we'll see what happens.
Yeah, and unlike some other episodes we've done, he's not... There's not a lot of terribly famous people in this. I'm trying to think who's who, because, again, these are kind of indifferent caricatures.
Well, I had to look it up on the wiki, but the major was...
William Wyndham.
Yeah, he was a TV actor who was also in a bunch of movies. And one of them was he was the prosecutor in the To Kill a Mockingbird adaptation.
Sure, and I mean, he shows up in a lot of John Hughes stuff too, including Planes, Trains, Uncle Buck. He is actually, I think, more known as a writer, but back in the 60s, they would just also then slot you in. I mean, Rod Serling is a good example of that. But he shows up in, of course, Twilight Zone, but also Star Trek, Columbo, Gunsmoke, and Mission Impossible, Magnum P.I., L.A. Law, et cetera, down the line. You know.
I mean, we're not trying to give these people shit. They had amazing careers because it's fucking hard to work as an actor.
Well, it's funny because back then, it's, I guess, a lot like now in TV where, like, you were just kind of all hands, right? Like, I mean, again, it's like, well, I could pitch you a Netflix series, but that means I also have to probably either direct or co-star in it because that's just the nature of a, you know, whatever, $2,000 a week budget that they had or whatever. It was nothing, right? And this was still filmed on film stock. If they had digital stock now or then, it would have been even no budget. Like, it really would have been nothing.
Well, because all you need is a costume budget and production design. Actually, did you ever see that Jim Henson TV movie, The Cube?
Yes.
This reminded me a lot of that, where it's this guy who's trying to escape from his enclosed cube, but he can't because people come in and tell him, nah, you can't get out, and then he can't get out.
Or you mean the second act of Toy Story 2, or the whole Buzz Lightyear thing?
Oh, yeah.
In Toy Story 1. I mean, yeah, I guess that's a spoiler at the end. These are five toys in a bucket.
Yeah, let's go ahead and get there, because it's very hard to talk about this episode without mentioning that, because this episode plays like a parody of a lot of the other Twilight Zones, because most of it's them speculating why they're there and who they are. So they like say, oh, we've been abducted by aliens, which was
this Twilight Zone.
was a theme in the Twilight Zone. Or, oh, this is hell. We're all in hell, which, yeah. Again... a twist in another Twilight Zone episode.
I mean, this is Rod Serling having fun with himself even further, because it's like, oh, of course there's an Army Major, right?
Yeah.
Because, like, Army Majors play a role in, like, roughly a quarter of these. Like, and, of course, we've done the exceptional ones, but if you turned, like, just randomly hit shuffle and tuned into one in the first season, half of them are Army people.
Or there's also, you know, the woman, the one woman character, and this is a very traditional female character. She's a literal ballet dancer who I guess tries to take on the nurturing role of for the other characters. The clown is the ironic character, I guess, who's the only one that kind of sort of knows what's going on but just won't say or pretends like it's not worth knowing.
Yeah, totally. But yeah, I mean... there's not a whole bunch here other than, you know, the hobo character, a weird bagpiper, a ballet dancer, and the clown.
Oh, what was that scene where the bagpiper and the ballerina decide, oh, you know what, Major, we'll cheer you up. I'll dance while the bagpiper plays. And that's just the most bizarre combination.
Well, and again, like, you have to imagine that this is also half Brazil, almost, because these are caricatures. They're not, like... with the exception of the Army Major, who's dressed in pretty realistic dress, everyone else on screen is, like, very cartoonish. And the walls and the way that it's filmed with kind of a curved wall and a Dutch angle, it seems heightened. Again, like a Fritz Lang movie or something. It's they're really doing a lot with nothing.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because they also reference the fact that everybody's a heightened caricature. I'm going to go ahead and mispronounce this, and Nick can correct me and throw something at me.
Good luck.
Even the clown, when they're trying to get a rope in order to see if they can get out of the top, he says that I'll pull this string off my suit courtesy of Pagliacci.
Pagliacci.
Pagliacci. Okay.
Pagliacci.
And I'm ducking now because here comes the the object. But yeah, I mean, they're acknowledging that... on a basic level, this is all kind of ridiculous.
That's right. And, you know, there's no food, there's no water, but they don't seem to need it.
Well, they're not hungry, they're not thirsty, they never get tired.
They have no memory of who they are, really, other than their caricatures.
Right.
Where they came from or how they ended up in the bucket.
Now, this reminded me of a whole bunch of things, because this has been quoted a lot. You've seen the movie Cube, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is pretty much that movie.
Well, and I like Jim Henson, but Jim Henson is nothing...
Not the Jim Henson movie. The movie in the, like, late 90s where it's like these six people wake up in a cube and they don't know how they got there.
I mean, or I guess the horror version of this is Saw.
Yeah.
Right? Like, but again, what's charming about the Twilight Zone is there's a message, not necessarily a moral... right? It's there for that Shyamalanian twist.
I don't even think it's Shyamalanian. What a twist.
Yeah.
I really do think this was just Rod Serling taking the piss, you know?
Yeah. No, totally. And it's kind of like, well, you guys want me to do something big each time? Fuck you, these are toys. Right? Like,
right.
This reminds me a lot of, what was that one? We did the end of season one, where the writer could create everything with his words.
Hmm.
You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, I remember. I'm blanking on the episode title, but give me 1 second, and I can find it.
I got it. A World of His Own.
Yes, that's it.
Because it does, which is ironically not written by Rod, but it has the same kind of feel. Like, oh, this is the world of someone's creation, right? And I guess, again, as much as this is whatever it is, I feel like someone saw this and made Toy Story. You know, this is John Lasseter's muse as well, because, you know, unless you're Uwe Boll or...
you know, he apparently runs a successful restaurant in Canada now.
I'm sure he does. Is it an Applebee's? No, I mean...
No, like, it's a legit restaurant. It's apparently... apparently fairly good.
Can you buy something called the U-Bowl? And it's like a bowl of something?
I honestly don't know.
I was going to say, like, Jim Henson, it makes sense because, I mean, I guess plug to Kevin Perger. He did an incredible Henson series. But, like, I get the feeling that, yes, Jim Henson knows classic Hollywood inside and out. And that's why when you do Muppets Take Manhattan, everything in it is essentially a reference to a Bogey, a Bacall, Olivia de Havilland, I mean, speaking of, happy 104th birthday, Olivia.
She's still alive?
She had a birthday last week at 104.
happy 104th birthday. I didn't realize that she was still with us.
Yeah. And so, yeah, there's little bits here of him just saying, you know, you want me to write characters? I'll write you characters. Like, it's just, it's so silly. It's so fun. And they try to get out. They try to climb up. They're a little too short, even though there's a fifth. They try to make a grappling hook.
Now, the one thing we haven't mentioned yet that we should is they're constantly hearing this extremely loud bell. Like, right. This bell rings. It causes them all to be knocked to their feet. And the first time they try to actually get up through this barrel, the only reason they fall is because of the bell.
Right. And that's always one of those damn things I hate in TV shows where, like, it almost works. Try it again. Just try it again.
Well, again, though, I think this was meant to be a subversion of that plot point because the Twilight Zone's used that before.
Sure. And we'll get to the second episode, which pairs weirdly but interestingly with this one, in that patterns are interesting, right? In classic script writing, you want there to be a pattern that repeats and repeats and then ultimately pays off or not. The second one is the complete opposite of that, right? This one, there's no particular reason they don't necessarily understand other than the Major's desire to escape. The second one, which we'll get to, Nothing in the Dark, there's a very real, very different thing beckoning this poor old woman.
The real surprising thing is they constantly hint that the twist is going to be so much smarter than it is. Like, they're quoting Jorge Luis Borges stories in this when they all suggest, oh, one of us is dreaming and they've invented the other four of you. And, hell is other people thing? That was Sartre, right?
It is, or Descartes, or the imagined sphere, mm-hmm. or, yeah, no, it is. It's funny, and eventually there's a complete breakdown in rationality, especially with the hobo who should always be played by the crazy guy from that Will the Real Martian Please Stand Up?
Yes.
Right?
I love
you
that guy.
You could be the fake one and I'm real. My whole bowl of beans. I like to think he was the one who drank 14 cups of coffee in that episode, though I honestly don't think that's true.
Well, I mean, this was the early 60s. 14 cups of coffee and cigarettes was considered breakfast.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine? I mean, and also, I mean, this is back in the day. Like, for those of you who can't imagine me, just imagine a 6'5" guy who really likes his McDonald's. But those guys from the 1960s, that's why McDonald's still sells coffee. Because you got to get that Big Mac. And a hot black coffee to wash it all down with. You sit there with the paper. You show up for what those young millennials call brunch. And you get there and read your paper and eat your Big Mac and drink your black coffee.
I always imagine less McDonald's and more. That's why Steak and Shake or Waffle Ooh. House still exists.
Oh, God. You're not... You don't know the half of it. I'm down. I do... I will indulge in a whole $14 at Waffle House, which is 4,000 calories.
That'll do it.
Yeah, fucking A.
Oh, they serve steak at Waffle House, man.
They serve everything at Waffle House. They serve on the same griddle that they're flipping pancakes and, like, cooking bacon on, they'll cook you a chicken patty that will taste like hash browns. That's something. That is something. Dude, I mean, I'm sure this is a game that that kids still play, but, like, how much can you eat at Waffle House? And if you can break 20 bucks, you're a goddamn champion. It's just nonsense food. I mean, we could wrap this episode up. There's not a lot here to talk about other than to say it's a solid episode.
It's a very solid episode. I disagree. Plot-wise, there's not a lot to talk about. It's just five characters
in search of an exit.
Yeah. I really do like this because this was at a point where the Twilight Zone, this was what, still the third season?
Yeah, but we're about halfway through the third season.
Right, so everybody who was watching this knew basically what to expect. They knew that there was going to be this twist at the end. They knew that there was going to be some sort of moral. And this episode subverts all of that. And honestly, I think that's what makes it work. It's maybe the first meta TV episode ever? Maybe?
It's got to be up there. Because I'm just trying to think. Like, there isn't an episode of the Beverly Hills. Well, Beverly Hillbillies was after this anyway. There isn't an episode of the Flintstones where they're like, hey, Bon, are we cartoon characters? Right?
Gee, Fred.
Hey, Bon, are we ripoffs of Jackie Gleason?
Yeah, that's right.
No,
Hey, Bon, I was watching TV one day. That guy sounds a lot like me.
God, my Fred is getting worse. Jesus Christ.
Well, what actually happens, just so we can explain what happens plot-wise, is they all stand on each other's shoulders to see how close they are to the top, and when the five of them are standing, the ballerina's at the top, and she can almost reach it, but then a bell starts ringing, and they all fall down. So...
Yeah.
They realize...
Not to interrupt, but of course to interrupt. At that point, that's when... I believe it's the clown, the optimistic one, is the one who then says, like, this is, you know, we're in hell. This is where we get kind of the Sisyphean, like, idea of, you know, Dante's hell, where all he wants to do is entertain, and he is trapped, therefore.
I don't think it's optimistic on his part. He just was trying to ignore and didn't care about the reality because there was no way that he could change it.
That's true, but he has been the levity. And then he loses it in that moment, right? And even though he says it in a sardonic way, he is like, oh, we're in hell, right?
Well, after that, though, earlier the Major had taken, like, a sword, like this Civil War-era sword to see if he could break through the walls.
Yep.
And he couldn't, so the sword broke in half. But he decides... Oh, okay, you know what? We're going to use this other half of the handle as a grappling hook. Everybody just tear off strips of your clothes so we can make this rope, and then I guess we'll get out.
That's right. He also, then I think, almost gets to the edge.
Well, he does get to the edge.
And then falls back in.
No, he gets to the edge and he falls down, and then there's that little girl who finds an army major doll in the snow.
Right.
And that's when we see the woman ringing the bell saying, please donate dolls to the orphans for Christmas.
That's right. And it's essentially a woman. What is the group where the Santas ring the bell outside on Christmas?
The Salvation Army?
It's essentially a Salvation Army woman taking donations of toys, right? And she's ringing the bell. That's the bell that caused the ringing. And now the five characters are down. Their makeup has been tweaked just a bit, so they have kind of a glassiness to their expression.
That final shot was great when they're panning over the dolls. And, well, actually, after he falls out, you know, we see the Major, and the doll replica of him looks great. It looks like the actor.
This is the cheapest episode you could find. I don't know. This is CBS, who at that point was not owned by anyone. They were independent, right? Like, they weren't owned by Viacom or something. There wasn't a studio.
Right.
But I'm sure the CBS lot just had a thing, and he just like, all right, you're a ballerina, you're a hobo, you're, you know, again. And the hobo is a cartoon out of a Jackie Gleason show, right? Like,
they all are. The bagpipe's got that ridiculous Scottish accent that he's clearly faking. And,
totally. And then... the dolls move their hand, and the ballet dancer holds the Major's hand.
And then she starts crying.
And you're just like, oh, shit.
Well, yeah, the pan is, I think they've got their eyes closed, and somebody's, like, painted makeup to make it look like doll's eyes over their eyelids.
Right.
It's the 60s. Apparently nobody cared if that would cause blindness.
And, oh, God. Watching some old Star Trek, there was one where...
dude, some red shirt is taken over by like a god being, and they just put contacts in his eyes to make it look glassy, right? But literally what it was is two sets of contact lenses with literally painted with white paint in between the two, and you're just like, oh dude. Yeah.
It's a red shirt. The red shirt's got to get named somehow.
Get cancer like 40 years later.
But yeah, that's what happens. It's a pan over, and a couple of them don't move. I think only the ballerina moves, and she reaches out to the army major's hand because that little girl dropped the major doll back in the barrel.
Yep.
And then she starts crying, and then we get the final Serling monologue, which I'll leave to you.
Just a barrel. A dark depository where are kept the counterfeit, make-believe pieces of plaster and cloth, wrought in a distorted image of human life. But this added hopeful note, perhaps they're unloved only for a moment. What a bleep.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension, a dimension of sound. A dimension of sight, a dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
We're back. Hey, look at that. Magic of recording. Episode 2 this week is Nothing in the Dark, which is the 81st episode overall, the 16th episode of the season. There's like 4 good ones in a row. And then we jump to season 4 almost, or season 5, really. We'll have to talk about what happened with season 4 on the next episode, because that's the last episode.
Season 4, I think everybody says is a train wreck.
Well, clearly, because none of them made the list.
Well, they changed the format, which...
Went to an hour?
Well, I mean, like, these episodes are 30 minutes. It went to an hour. I mean, these days, you know, watching without commercials, they're 45 minutes, but...
Right. As opposed to the tight 23, which this one is. And by the by, it's my problem with a lot of shows from the 60s. It's not even that I'm used to the 44 and a quarter minutes now, because that's even gotten shorter in our lifetime. When we were kids, it was 45 to 46 minutes, and now it's 44 minutes and 12 seconds, mm-hmm. or whatever it is. But a lot of that start, like old Star Treks, for example, is probably the most common show you guys have watched from the 60s other than this. That's an hour long. You're just like, man, if you could take 8 minutes off of this, you've got something. But it's a lot of just Spock dicking around and getting kind of yelled at like a racist by McCoy.
I'm extending the runtime as much as I can, Captain.
I can't reach the engines.
Star Trek 11.
Spock, can you get to the plot a little quicker? Anyway, so Nothing in the Dark.
I'm sorry, that would not be logical.
That's right. We didn't really get to it, but like Rod, of course, shows up in this one. He didn't write this one, though. This is a person named George Clayton Johnson.
Is it based on a short story or a novel or anything?
Best I can tell, it just comes out of George Clayton Johnson, who we visited before, because George Clayton Johnson also wrote A Game of Pool.
Ah, yes, okay.
And he's also the one who wrote the first script for Star Trek, which I mentioned then, and did Ocean's 11, the 60s version, which was, of course, remade in 2001, into what I think is a fantastic movie.
R.I.P. Carl Reiner.
Oh, that's right. You know what? That's a movie we should rewatch for the podcast. Obviously, by the time it comes out, he's been passed away for months, but...
I mean, that was a big deal when that got released back in the day.
But, I mean, I learned about him from the 2000-Year-Old Man, which is a classic. and, of course, an incredible episode from back when it was on Crackle of Seinfeld's show, Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, because the episode was about him and Mel Brooks, and Carl Reiner just came over. So you have Jerry Seinfeld sitting at their, like, they have a kitchen bar. Like, you know, like a breakfast bar. Mm-hmm. And he's just sitting there, and these two old men are kvetching over the roast chicken that Jerry picks up for them. And just watching.
Well, apparently, and I know we're getting off topic, but he...
gives a shit.
Well, as we're recording this, Carl Reiner passed away earlier this week. He and Mel Brooks would get together each night to watch Jeopardy.
Yeah, that's right. Those two, of course... 70 years as best friends. Hey, you and I are 63 years away. We've got this. But you, and then, like, Dick Van Dyke, who's also still alive, is like, I'll miss my buddy. And you're just like, how, like, something about old comedy guys from the 40s. Like, they were writing for the show of shows in the 1950s. Dear Lord. Anyway, so Nothing in the Dark is about an old woman who's afraid of death. Weird. Weird.
Interesting transition there.
Yeah, I know. Seamless. an old woman... An old woman living in a nightmare. By the way, this is great because we get this woman who is like this old, frail, elderly, wearing kind of a shawl.
Well, she's living in a literal shack. I mean, the windows are all boarded up. The
we find out later it's the basement of a tenement they're going to tear down.
It looks like a human shouldn't be able to live there.
Right. And she is asleep and is wakened by an altercation outside. She hears a gunshot, and a guy says, please open the door, I'm a cop. And even though she's by herself, we pan across a mirror, and there's good old Rod smiling in her ear. And he goes, an old woman living in a nightmare. An old woman who has fought 1,000 battles with death and always won. Now she's faced with a grim decision, whether or not to open a door. And in some strange and frightening way, she knows that this seemingly ordinary door leads to the Twilight Zone. Mm.
Now, I'm just going to go ahead and say this. And again, if Nick throws something at me, he's just going to throw something at me. In a TV episode that's around a person who's afraid to open a door to a police officer, which that's what's happening. A police right. officer was shot and is begging for help. And she's afraid to open it because the cop may be Mr. Death and kill her. Well, we're recording this a little over a month after George Floyd was murdered. Kind of plays differently these days.
It does. And, of course, further, the whole episode is playing up that this woman may, in fact, be completely crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Because death looks different every time. I was at the funeral of a friend, or I think the first one is that I was on a bus.
She was on a bus.
And this woman stumbled, older woman stumbled, and she this young man helps her catch her balance and gets on the bus, and then by the end of the bus ride, she was dead.
Yep.
And so she's afraid that if death touches her, so to speak, she'll die.
Now, we usually play this game with these episodes in terms of the cast, but I'm just going to go ahead and say it. Hollywood legend Robert Redford plays the police officer who was shot.
Yeah, when she, like, the whole thing is, again, she's that, for anyone who's lived in an apartment complex, she's that old lady who just opens the door, but the chain is still attached to mm-hmm. peer out, and we see lying in the snow this cop. Yeah. I mean, like, we see the, you know, the bronze shield on his chest.
Well, before we get to that, she, for a couple minutes of the episode, she just refuses to open the door at all. He keeps begging her.
That's right. And him lying in the snow there is just this blonde whatever. I mean, and I saw this last night. I was drinking a whiskey, which was really helping the Xanax hum. but it looks like a young Cary Elwes or something. Like, it's just this guy with, you know, blonde hair, politely asking for help very, very pleasantly. Not at all aggressive, which turns out to matter later. Like, that's why I'm emphasizing it now. But I think her name is Wanda. And she lives in this tenement nothing. And
she's the last person there. This is like Blade Runner.
Well, and that's the story that she gets out. He goes, well, last week it was he came disguised as the gas... The guy to read the gas meter, and then a contractor, and like, if this was a Southern Gothic, she would have been shooting like over their heads to tell them to get off her property, and that's kind of what's going on here. By the way, the woman is Gladys Cooper,
yes,
who has been in everything.
Well, I mean, she was nominated for an Oscar like what, 3 times?
Yeah, My Fair Lady, in fact, one of my favorites. Song of Bernadette and now Voyager as well.
Oh, who's she in My Fair Lady?
Best Supporting, I couldn't tell you. This is one of the old... Oh, okay, she's Rex Harrison's mother, Mrs. Higgins.
Oh, good lord.
Yeah, there you go.
Yep, that makes sense.
Yep. Especially since that was a year after this. I mean, and that's not to say anything, but the woman was born in 1888. So by 1960s, she's an old woman, right? She's almost 80 when this one came out.
She passed away not too long. Well, not relatively. Too long. Like by 1969, I think she passed away, right?
69, early 70s. She's in Disney's last movie, by the by.
The Dennis Hopper movie that... No, I'm kidding.
No.
That is what we in the business call a deep pull.
That's right. So the last movie Walt Disney wanted to make before he died was called The Happiest Millionaire. And he had bought the rights. He was working on the production. He, I think, is only probably listed as a producer because he died soon after. Mm-hmm. And when he died... By the way, it's one of these, like... nightmare stories of Hollywood where no one thought it was a good idea. It's a weird script. Essentially, this dude is, well, I mean, it's in the title. It's the happiest millionaire. But then Walt dies. And for those people who are around Walt Disney, it wasn't like a Meyer from MGM where everyone just saw him as a businessman. People saw Walt Disney as a brilliant human being, a creative type. And you're not going to cancel Epcot Center after he dies. You're going to freaking build Epcot. And so The Happiest Millionaire was the last movie he worked on. And apparently no one thought it was working. The script designer, the director, because there was because he was working on Walt Disney World.
But it's what Walt would have
it's
wanted.
It's what Walt would have wanted. And so they released it anyway. And it sank like, like a fishing lure, man.
Oh, I mean, hey, we've got this... We've got this one spinoff podcast out about Disremembered, which is all about the Walt Disney Company. And after Walt died, until Michael Eisner took over, they had no idea what they were doing.
In 1967, it cost $5 million to make, and it earned $5 million, which means it lost $5 million.
Right.
Because that doesn't count advertising. That doesn't count anything else. Yeah, that is a sinking ship.
Those goddamn hippies, they'd show up to Alice in Wonderland dropping acid, but they wouldn't show up to that.
That's right. But although the guy that it's based on is truly fascinating. He was a dude who, after World War I, had PTSD, so he goes to like what they used to call the Far East. He learns martial arts, and then before World War II starts, he becomes the official hand-to-hand combat trainer for the Marines.
Now, and this isn't a canon movie, is it?
No, but doesn't it sound like one? He even had a room in his house filled with alligators.
Well, unfortunately, you know who wasn't elected to teach hand-to-hand combat is Gladys Cooper.
That's right. Let's pull this back. Or Robert Redford.
Yeah.
I like Robert Redford.
Well, how can you not?
Oh,
future president Robert Redford.
That's right. Charming as hell Robert Redford. Anyway.
Watchman joke.
And I swear he was the president of something else, too. Maybe not. Oh, sorry. I was thinking of all the president's men. He's not the president there.
No, he is
not. He takes down the president there. The rest of this episode is effectively... the middle act is he convinces her to bring him in. He's recuperating on the bed, and he goes, well, the doctor will be coming soon, right? And she stalls, and he goes, didn't you call the doctor? She goes, I don't have a phone. I'm the only one left.
Right, and there's no neighbors that I can go to.
Right. And so they're having small talk. And then,
well, she explains, like, why she's this lonely recluse, which is that she's scared of Mr. Death. And she even uses the old standby line of, I know it sounds crazy, but it's the truth.
And then goes through the story we talked about, the bus, and like all these times where... But again, what is good about this episode is so much of it is like, oh, dude, no, that was just a guy from the gas company. Mm-hmm. Oh, that was just the man from the city.
Well, we'll skip ahead a little bit because...
there's not much to skip to. Indiana Jones shows up.
A little bit.
He has a fedora, the leather coat, and the... Right.
Well, the city contractor who's been assigned to demolish this block
tenement.
Of buildings, and yeah, the tenement, he shows up, and originally she opens the door and refuses to let him in because, you know, it's eminent domain. I guess she's got to get out.
Well, and he's like, look, the city is going to knock this down in an hour. We're trying to get you out. And she essentially gets thrown back by the door because she tries to slam the door in his face.
She does, but then he sticks a shoe in there and then he pushes the door back. And that's actually the commercial break, which we don't mention too much on this show, where he does that and then she falls down and hits her head and then it seems like she's dead.
Right. Because, and in fact, what he does is he reaches up to check her, assume her pulse, right? Reaches up to her neck. But since when she was talking to good old Robbie Reds on the bed, she said all he needed to do was touch her, the woman on the bus, and then she was dead. And so we're like, oh, shit!
Well, actually, the contractor's presence kind of gives away the twist because it's like, okay, this entire block is abandoned. The city's tearing it down. Why is anyone there? Why is there a police officer in this area?
I didn't think that it's entirely possible that there were other people squatting nearby. You know, I mean, it's an abandoned building and it's snowing.
It's possible, but I mean, that was just my immediate thought.
To me, the thing that gave it away, we'll get there, but he has bandages on. We just don't see anything about how the bandaging comes about. It's not that the bandaging matters ever, but there's no blood in the snow. Like, Twilight Zone hasn't shied away from violence
before. Right.
But whatever. What happens is the contractor guy essentially lays her out on the couch. She wakes up and sees him there. She goes, oh, my God, what happened? He goes, look, I'm sorry, you knocked out, but you got to get out of here. My crews are coming in an hour. They're knocking down this building. And he goes, well, what am I going to do with my friend? And he goes, there's no one else here.
You know, that was interesting having the contractor in the episode because presumably death would be a lot like the contractor. It's just I don't take any pleasure letting people knowing that they're dead. It's just what I have to do.
Well, and that's kind of what the contractor says, right? He's like, look, we told you weeks ago. We've been trying to get to you for weeks. This building's coming down. We've offered you everything. You've ignored us.
I don't want to get the actual police involved, but it's going to happen. We're going to tear this down. And
she goes, what about the policeman over there? And he goes, there's no one there. We will get the police here. And then she looks over at him and goes, huh. And for me, for a second, this is one of the few episodes I thought you could make longer. Because then the question is, who's real? The contractor or the cop? But they play with that for all of about 2.5 minutes, right?
Yeah. Well, like you said, she tries to say, what about the cop, police officer that's here? And he's just like, well, there's no one there.
Yeah. And I said, good day, madam. and he walks out. And then...
well, then we get the scene where the woman's like, he looked right at you but didn't see you. What's going on? And Robert Redford is like, look in the mirror.
You got me. I'm not here. Which, by the way, is good directing. Because how do we establish that Rod Serling is there, but his narration is in the mirror and they turn over and he's also Rod Serling? He exists. They do not. Anyway, so Harold the cop is in fact death.
Yes.
And he stands up and smiles and says, I just wanted to gain your trust.
Well, that's the whole thing. She was afraid of death, but then he's like, well, I mean, I haven't done anything mean to you. I haven't threatened you. I haven't hit you. I haven't done anything. I'm just here because I have to be.
And she goes... I think her last line is almost, will it hurt? And they pan over and she's dead on the couch. And he goes...
Well, what happens is he tries to convince Gladys Cooper to take his hand. And this is actually something I still don't get. He's like saying, come on, trust me. It's going to be okay. And then he calls her mother, which made me think, wait, what? What's going on? How long has she been trying to escape death?
I think the writer was dealing with something right now.
Sure.
Yeah, but I mean, so effectively, you know, this handsome young man takes first her hand and then her elbow after seeing the woman dead on the bed.
I got to stop you right there. Handsome young man? This is Robert Redford.
He is a handsome young... Oh, please. Oh,
Oh,
the handsomest.
He is a snack, girl.
Dude. And in this, like, I don't know what you think of when you think of Robert Redford. I'm all the president's men, but, like, that came out, what,
76.
A decade later?
Mm-hmm.
12 years later? Like, at this point, he must have been in his 20s. Like, he's a handsome dude.
Oh, yeah.
The only thing I had wished about the end of this, he you know, she sees her dead, and, like, again, death isn't scary. It's something that happens. And he's walking her out of the stairway. This would have been beautiful. If, you know, they walk out the door closes behind them, right? And then they walk past the window. If when they walk past the window, it was the same Mr. Death from the first episode.
Oh, that would have been good.
Right? Because it's the same role, but instead of a cop's uniform, he's just like a man in black. Black suit, black tie. And it's just that, I mean, brunette guy. The problem, I guess, by season three, you were too big of a show to have a generic nothing character actor. You got Robert Redford. You're going to be Robert Redford.
But well, this was before Robert Redford, you know, got big.
Got big, but he was still a known...
Oh, he did a bunch of TV, yeah.
But anyway, so, I mean, I'll give the closing narration. We'll decide which one's better. There's an old woman who lived in a room. And, like all of us, was frightened of the dark. But who discovered in a minute, the last fragment of her life, that there was nothing in the dark that wasn't there when the lights were on. Object lesson for the more frightened among us, out in the Twilight Zone.
Mm-hmm.
My God. Again, it's down to the writing, but this is such a weird bottle episode. Because in a bottle episode, usually it's like, we all know each other.
I don't disagree. This is a... certainly an unusual bottle episode just based on the setting, which would still be pretty weird these days. I mean, an abandoned tenement.
Well, I mean, one of my favorite shows that I haven't rewatched in a while or caught up on, admittedly, is Red Dwarf, because it's always the same three people. And so whenever someone new shows up, you're like, the fuck? Right? Because this old woman has been in her room, and she says, for years, there's a boy who delivers me groceries. I leave out lists and money, and then I wait till he's gone to show up, and then all of a sudden, she meets two people in one day, and then she's dead. Anyway, so Sudsy, which one of these two would you pick?
Oh, five characters, definitely. I hadn't seen Nothing in the Dark before this, but it's interesting, but the biggest thing about it is the fact that Robert Redford was in this before he really launched his mainstream career. So it's kind of a footnote. It's interestingly written, but we've already done episodes that are very much about death and people confronting it. And this one, it just kind of felt redundant, but five characters is a parody, a perfect parody of a lot of Twilight Zone tropes. And honestly, even beyond that, it was just a lot more well-written and a lot more, it was a lot funnier, frankly.
I will agree with you, and I won't disagree with anything you say other than to say you should still watch the second episode because it does something which a lot of them don't do, in that Daniel even said in the first episode, there's a lot of stereotypical characters in all these Twilight Zone episodes because what he does well is play with stereotypes. You see the guy in the military uniform, you assume that they are strong-jawed white Americans who believe in very few nonsense, and that's why the aliens are scary, because it should fit outside of their belief structure. This episode, the second episode, the latter episode, Nothing in the Dark, is the opposite of all of that, because she doesn't act like an old maternal grandmother type. We've had that episode. That's the one with the ghost phone.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say it's interesting because the person who wrote it didn't play with stereotypes, which is why he wrote for Star Trek, I guess. But yeah, no, I think Daniel's right. Five characters in search of an exit plays the episode arc better. So because we already jumped to season five when I was with Ben Wooster, next week is our last episode of this side project. So thanks, guys. I hope you enjoyed it. Let us know everywhere you can let us know. And besides, maybe it's for the best that we leave the Twilight Zone. Zone.
The Twilight Zone Zone is a production of Dude Letter Podcasting and Myopia Defend Your Childhood. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman, paneled by Daniel S. and Matt Quinn. It is edited by Nick and Daniel. The theme song is Six Impromptus, Opus 5, Impromptu 5 by Jean Sibelius. The list is from Vanity Fair, the 26 episodes we talk about when we talk about The Twilight Zone by Donald Liebenson. The Twilight Zone is created, hosted, and mostly written by Rod Sterling. The Twilight Zone and all clips are owned by CBS Television and Cayuga Productions.